When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours.
Good afternoon, Atlanta. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. We have a new open. I hope you like it. You can always let me know on Twitter at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. I want to start the show today a little bit differently. We have with us on the phone Reuben Brown. He's with the Red Cross in Atlanta. And I wanted to have an update on what's going on with the typhoon, because there has been so much going on in this country over the last few weeks that the worst storm, arguably the worst storm to have ever hit this part of the country, this part of the world, has destroyed just hundreds of thousands of lives. And I feel like the story of this typhoon has been really lost in all of the other things that are going on as we head into the end of this year. And so I invited Reuben to come on and talk to us a little bit about what's going on with Typhoon Haiyan and how we can help here in Atlanta. Because one thing I have learned from 15 years on the air is that this city, this metro area, this state is so incredibly giving that when there is a need, we all step up. And so, Reuben, welcome to the Elise Glink Show. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Perfect. Thank you for coming on today. Am I pronouncing that correctly, Haiyan?
Yes, you are. Haiyan.
Haiyan.
Yes.
Tell us what is going on from the Red Cross's perspective. On the ground, we're now, 10 days out from this incredible typhoon or so. What's the situation like on the ground there?
Well, while relief efforts are well underway, blocked roads, destroyed infrastructure, and downed communications lines have made the early days of the response especially challenging for Red Crossers. The airports have resumed operations, and more roads and bridges are now passable. But fuel and vehicle shortages continue to hinder the access to affected areas that lack food and water. And this is typical for major disasters, both internationally and in the United States. You know, think back to Haiti, for example, the earthquake. You had crumbled infrastructure, communications down. You had roads that were impassable. And so this is something that we frequently encounter when you have catastrophic incidents like the typhoon that recently hit the Philippines.
I was reading this morning online, and I saw that, and this is really striking, that there are something like 220,000 pregnant women in the area that was hit by the typhoon, and a lot of them are in areas that have no water, have no food, have no electricity, are impassable, and they're having to give birth in, you know, this is something that you can't quite keep your legs crossed about, right? Eventually,
sure,
they're going to come out, and it's very, very dangerous for just a whole lot of women right now in particular. What can our local citizens here do to help?
Well, first of all, I want to second what you said earlier. You started the show by saying that when something like this happens, Georgians, Atlantans, people in this area step up and they assist in the relief effort. And I want to second that, because I've worked for the Red Cross approaching 20 years, and every time something happens, whether it's something local, something that's national, international, Georgians step up and help out. And so I want to second that. The way that people can help us out in this instance is simply to go to redcross.org. Right there on the landing page on our national website, you'll see a donate button. You click that button, you make your donation, and you can rest assured that your money is going to go to help people who are in desperate need. One thing I also want to add, people ask us why we don't take material, what we call in-kind donations. And that's simply because it's more efficient for the Red Cross to take those financial resources, those monetary donations, and convert them immediately into what people need, whether it's water, formula, whether it's fuel for vehicles, whatever they need. And especially in this situation, it just makes it a more efficient process for the Red Cross.
Are you finding that, and I saw some pictures over the weekend of kind of the shoreline, and I'm sure everybody who's listening to this has gone on to Google and done these sort of before and after image shots, aerial images. The devastation is massive. It's hard to even imagine. Just because, okay, so let me back up. I was in New Orleans after we had the flooding and Katrina, and then they had the flooding in the lower ninth. And I have to say that there, which was, you just walked for block, and it was completely wiped out. I mean, houses were twisted off their, they were just off the foundations. There was just like nothing was standing. It was just really surreal. And this is 100 times bigger?
Yeah. Well, you know, this typhoon is testament to the power, the raw power of nature. I mean, Red Cross, we faced incidents like this before. You mentioned Katrina. Here locally in the metro Atlanta area in Georgia, we had a devastating flood back in 2009. We had Superstorm Sandy last year. So, yeah, we have seen devastating storms, devastating disasters, and that's the bad news. The good news is that the Red Cross and other agencies, you know, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. We know that this is going to be a long-term proposition. We know that the Red Cross will be there for weeks, if not months, if not years. I mentioned Haiti again. The Red Cross is still on the ground providing assistance there. So it may seem like it's something that's insurmountable at this point, and I know that it just blows you away when you see the imagery, the suffering that the people there have had to endure. But it's good to know that the Red Cross, our volunteers who are second to none, have hearts of gold and spirits just as strong, are going to be there for the long haul to help people get on the road to recovery.
So, Reuben, when you look at this kind of a disaster compared to, say, a Haiti, where, you know, a friend of mine who's a videographer for Fox News told me that she's, you know, recently, well, I think she probably is about 2 or 3 months ago now, which in my world is yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, she was back down in Haiti, and they were doing some follow-up work, and she said, you know, there's this huge push right at the beginning of one of these kinds of massive disasters, and then you end up in a situation where it just takes so long to rebuild. People kind of forget about it. I mean, just look what happens in the United States in an average week. I mean, you've got major news stories breaking about every 6 minutes.
Exactly.
And so these kinds of massive disasters just kind of, you know, fall a little bit off to the wayside. Whereas in Haiti, has it been 2 or 3 years?
It's been 3 years. 2010.
Right. So 3 years. And you can think about all the things that have happened in this country since 2010,
right.
but there, it still isn't all fixed.
Right. And again, it has to do with infrastructure, some things that you just can't navigate in a very expeditious fashion. It takes time. Again, you look at the raw power of these things, and, you know, they come in and it may take man months, if not weeks, to undo what nature has done. And so this will no doubt be a very similar situation. I've seen the imagery, I've seen the pictures. You know, we're getting a stream of pictures from our international volunteers on a daily basis, which are telling the story, the smells, the destruction, the misery, the suffering that they're seeing on the streets of the Philippines. And we know, again, that people there are in need, desperate need. But thanks to people like you, helping the Red Cross to keep this front and center of the public's consciousness, letting the public know that, you know, it's going to take a long time for us to deal with this. And again, it may take weeks, if not months. Certainly it's not a stretch to say it may take years to try to get that country back whole. But Red Cross will be there. We're prepared for this. This is something that we've done before. You know that when something hits, whether it's here in the United States, from the smallest home fire to the largest hurricane, the Red Cross is there, and whether it's short-term or long-term, we're prepared to provide assistance as long as needed to get the Philippine nation back on its feet and on the road to recovery.
So you can donate by going to redcross.org, redcross.org.
Absolutely.
And usually with these kinds of things, you have a phone donation set up as well. Do you have that for this as well?
Well, you can either go to redcross.org. That's the best route to take. Or you can call 1-800-RED-CROSS. That's 1-800-REDCROSS. All one word. And you can make your donation in either one of those ways. But you can rest assured, again, that people who are in desperate need are going to get that assistance. And as you said, Georgians never hesitate to step up. And I have no reservations at this point that they're going to do the same thing in this situation.
What has been surprising to you, having had this 20 years in the Red Cross. What's different about this typhoon and the aftermath versus some of the other? I know there's a lot of similarities, right? But what's different for you this time?
I would say, from what I've seen on television, just the utter devastation and the fact that, you know, this nation has been crippled before by typhoons and by other natural disasters. We had one recently, in fact, this past year. So it's like a 1-2 punch for the Philippines. And I think that is what is unique to me about this situation, the fact that they've had to endure two of these situations sort of back-to-back.
Right.
And so that, to me, is unique. But again, I always take solace, and I always know that, you know, the Red Cross is going to be there. We have legions of volunteers, both here in the United States and around the world, who are ready to respond. You know, one thing I think the public needs to know is that the Red Cross is international in scope. As a matter of fact, most independent countries have their own Red Cross or Red Crescent Society. In places where French is spoken, it's known as the Croix Rouge. In places where Spanish is spoken, it's known as the Cruz Roja. In Israel, it's known as the Magen David Adom. In Muslim nations, it's known as the Red Crescent. Now, the one thing that ties all of them together, no matter where they're situated around the world, is that they look after the health and the safety and welfare of people in those individual regions around the world, and this is no exception. We know that the Philippine Red Cross has had to endure a lot. We know that their burden is heavy, but we also know that sister societies around the world are stepping up to help them in this situation, and we're going to be there for them for the long term with the public's help.
So, Reuben, we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back, and I'm going to walk through some of these insane numbers of people and situations that have been affected by this particular typhoon, Haiyan. And if you'll stay with us, you know, we're just talking for a few more minutes about what it's going to take to rebuild in the Philippines after a storm that had unbelievable sustained winds of 195 miles an hour.
Yeah, extraordinary.
With gusts reaching 235 miles per hour. So stay with us. We're also taking your calls if you've got questions about this relief effort and what you can do. 404-872-0750. We're going to, you know, take more of your real estate, money, personal questions coming up after that. But I want to give us this opportunity to really reach out in the midst of everything else going on in our lives. And thank God that we're not in the middle of this situation and what we can do to help. 404-872-0750. This is the Elyse Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB.
Every Sunday, Elyse Glink is live and here to guide you through your money and real estate questions. Only on 95.5 FM and AM 750, News Talk WSB.
24 minutes past the hour on the Elyse Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. This half hour, I wanted to focus on Typhoon Haiyan, which is by almost every stretch of the imagination the most powerful storm to ever make landfall, according to the Weather Channel. 370 miles across, 195 mile an hour sustained winds, gusts reaching 235 miles an hour. It made landfall six times. It has had 27 inches of rain in one of the areas. They had a storm surge of 17 feet. 13 million people have been affected by this typhoon. Of those, 1.5 million are in children. People are hungry. There are 220,000 pregnant women in the affected area who are desperately needing attention. Roads are out. The devastation is huge. And I thought it was really important, as there's so much noise going on now in this country, that these people in this country not get forgotten by us. There's just too much going on. And so I've asked Reuben Brown from the Red Cross to sit in with us for this half hour to talk about what you can do. Reuben, you said earlier you'd like people to just go to redcross.org and make a donation. It's the easiest, fastest way to get relief. Is that right?
Absolutely, Elyse. That is the absolute quickest and most efficient way to do it. You simply go to redcross.org, and on our landing page, you'll see a donate button. You push that button, click it, and you can make your donation in that way. And rest assured that the people who desperately need the help are going to get the help through the American Red Cross and through the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies.
Do you need any people power? What else do you need besides money at this point?
Yes. Well, to be deployed to what we call the international theater or on international assignments, you have to get specialized training, as you might imagine. Thus far, the Red Cross has deployed about 10 specialists to the region, and they're helping with things like IT, communications, and disaster assessment. You know, as this disaster relief operation evolves, that number could go up. But at this point, we're simply asking for people to make those donations. And one other thing I want to mention, when you have an international relief effort, the American Red Cross really engages based on the requests, the level of requests, staffing, assets that the society that's been impacted makes. And so the Philippine Red Cross, we're basically reacting based on what they're asking us to provide for them in the way of support. And we're also acting in liaison with the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society. So it is truly a global effort to assist those in the Philippines.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Reuben, for joining us on a Sunday morning, taking some time out of what you usually do.
Well, I love the Red Cross. I love our volunteers, as I said earlier. They are second to none, and I want people to keep them in their prayers and thoughts as they're on the ground providing assistance to those in the Philippines, to Filipinos who are affected by the storm.
Well, I really appreciate you being here with us. Thank you so much. Reuben Brown is with the American Red Cross. You can go to redcross.org and donate to the Typhoon Haiyan relief effort, and I encourage you to do so, folks. It is really important that we help the 13 million people who have been affected by this typhoon. It is absolutely an astonishing number. Death toll is over 4,000, probably getting close now to 5,000. It's just an astonishing loss of life and devastation. Thank you so much for stepping up and helping out. RedCross.org. I'm Elise Glink. Rebuilding America One House at a Time will return after the break. Call now with your questions, 404-872-0750. Let me help you rebuild your life. 1-800-WSB-TALK on News Talk WSB. Minutes past the hour on the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Our number, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK, online on Twitter, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. And if you want, if you're into G+, Google+, you can add me there as well and be part of the ThinkLink community. Sharon has been waiting very patiently for a while. We've got some lines open, but I wanted to get to her call first. Sharon, welcome to the Elise Glink Show.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you. How are you today?
I'm wonderful. My husband and I, we're thinking about purchasing a home within the next couple of weeks using his VA loan for the first time.
Uh-huh.
And we ran across a property that we didn't put an offer on it, but then it said VA loan assumable. So my question is, how does that process work, and what are the pros and cons? And I'll hang up.
Well, don't hang up, because we might want to have a conversation about this. So don't go anywhere.
Okay.
So assumable loans are only available with FHA and VA loans. So what the whole concept of assumable loans is that you can step in where the loan is, and if you qualify, you can just take it over at the interest rate that it's at. Now, when interest rates are higher than the loan that you would assume, that's a good deal. But interest rates are extremely low right now. And so just because a loan is assumable doesn't mean that you want to assume it. And even if you do want to assume it, there are a couple of hurdles you have to get through. One of them is you have to qualify and be approved to assume that loan. So it's not just an automatic. And the second is that you often will have to come up with a whole lot of cash if there is a difference between the amount of the loan and the purchase price.
Okay.
So let's say that the purchase price is $150,000 and the loan has only $100,000, but the seller wants $150,000. You could assume the loan, but then you'd have to come up with another $50,000.
Okay.
So that's usually not the way it goes.
Okay.
Now, if the home is priced at $100,000 and the loan is $100,000, and the loan's at 3%, and the interest rates, going interest rates, are at 4 or 5%, then you'd want to look into assuming that loan.
Okay, so you're saying that, well, we were pre-qualified. Everything was already in order. And we were locked in at a 3.75 interest rate. So you're saying if the assumable loan was less than that, that would have been a good deal?
Well, it might have been a good deal, but it depends on how much cash you would have had to come up with to close on the deal. So usually people go with VA loans, veterans loans, because they don't have any cash for down payment or very little.
Okay.
Do you have cash for a down payment?
Yes, but we weren't planning on using it. That's why we wanted to go VA.
So if you could get are you looking at a zero down loan with VA at 3.75%?
Yes, zero down payment, yes.
That's a done deal as far as I'm concerned. Like, nobody can get a down payment loan for 3.75%. If that's still the case for you,
yes.
Boy, you should snap that up in a heartbeat.
Oh,
that's a good deal.
So you're saying assume the loan or don't?
Well, is the assumable loan at 3.75%?
Oh, I don't know, because we, like I said, we didn't make an offer because we started to look at another property that we were just thinking about what would that, if it was a good deal or not, and if it comes across again, we would know what to do.
Right. So what I'm trying to explain to you is that there are a bunch of moving pieces here.
Uh-huh.
And one of them is, how much cash do you have for this down payment? And two, could you even get a better deal than 3.75%? And my sense is you probably can't. Interest rates are higher than that right now. They're about 4.25%.
Right.
That's conventional. So if you really, so I'm a little confused. Do you really have a 3.75% interest rate?
Yes.
And when does that expire?
That expires, I believe, the end of November. That's what we're really trying to find a property before it expires.
Yeah, I would say. Because when you go back, it's going to be higher.
Okay.
So I don't think the question for you is assumable or not assumable, as long as you could, if you really have a 3.75% interest rate. I'm concerned you don't actually really have that.
Yes, we've been locked in for about 3 weeks now.
Okay, well then.
We closed on a property and it fell through, so now we're looking for another property so we can stay at that same interest rate.
Okay, so assuming you could stay at that same interest rate and you can get closed by the end of the month.
Uh-huh.
When it expires, which I don't know that you could do that either, right? Because that's just a short period of time from now.
Okay.
But assuming you can, then that's what you're going to do. And maybe one thing to do is to look for an FHA house or a HUD home at HUDHomeStore.com, because those houses are usually available immediately.
Okay.
So now let's talk about what might happen, Sharon, after the month ends and you no longer have that interest rate.
Okay.
So now you're going to get a loan and maybe it'll be 4.25 or 4.5.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be higher. And so you might run across an assumable loan that's lower.
Mm-hmm.
So now do you take that loan and do you try to assume it? And the answer is, if you can save money and the interest rate is lower and you have enough money to pay whatever the additional costs are outside of what the loan amount is, then you might want to consider it. But you're going to have to apply and be accepted by the lender that has that property. So I just want to make sure you understand that it isn't just a done deal.
Okay, I do understand. Okay.
Okay, and so let me just ask you one other little question, if I could.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you even looking at VA if you have cash for a down payment?
Because my husband never used it, and he has the cash, but he said if he doesn't have to put any cash down, he doesn't want to.
Why?
I guess he just assumed he earned that right by being a veteran. He don't have to put no cash down if he doesn't want to.
So first of all, you and he don't even know why he wants to do it that way, and I'm worried about the whole idea of not putting any cash down because property prices have fluctuated so much in Atlanta, and when you put zero down, and things happen, and suddenly you're underwater, and you have to sell. It's a much more difficult place to be than having equity in the property. And typically, interest rates and fees and all the rest are really higher with a zero down payment from the VA.
Mm-hmm.
and you end up paying extra costs that are built in. And so one of the stories that I wrote this week, and I'm going to talk about it more in depth on CBS News, was about how mortgage insurance with the FHA, how much it actually really costs you. And there was a new report out this week that borrowers can save between $1,700 and $12,000 over 5 years by going with a conventional loan with private mortgage insurance over an FHA loan.
Okay.
And so there's really, I think, a difference in cost that I know your husband thinks that he's earned the right to have a zero down loan. But honestly, is that why he really went into the service? I don't think so.
No, I don't know. No,
I'm pretty sure he had other reasons.
Right.
Beyond the idea that someday he could get a zero down loan, because really you guys could go with USDA and get a zero down loan. He didn't have to devote his life to service.
Okay.
So
okay.
I want you to understand a little bit more about what you guys are both thinking and what the true costs are. Because I think it's very easy with VA loans to get fooled into this idea that this is the way you have to go and that there's no other way to go, when in fact there may be a better and cheaper alternative right in front of your face and you're not looking at it.
Okay, okay. Let me ask you this. So as far as the cash down payment, does that include the VA funding fee? Is that a part of the down payment?
The VA funding fee is not, I do not believe that is part of the down payment.
Okay.
There are other fees that go into a VA loan. And so the way VA works is that, at least the last time I looked at it, which wasn't all that long ago, you know, when you put down 0%, the costs are the highest because the VA has to cover the fact that you may go under and the loss will be bigger. If you put down 5%, those costs go down. If you put down 10% and you get to 20%, there's no reason to even use VA. You can just use a conventional loan. But you should really explore other kinds of costs and do a comparison of what it would cost you with a conventional mortgage, meaning that just regular lending, you know, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac kind of loan, versus the FHA or versus a VA loan, and what that means. And I really encourage you to talk to a bunch of different lenders and get the pricing down. Now, if truly you've got 3.75% till the end of the month, go try and do that loan. But if it turns out that's not really the loan and there are other costs that somehow didn't get factored into that, please promise me that you and your husband will take the time to really investigate your different mortgage options and what they will cost you now and over the long run.
Okay, so if the good faith estimate said 3.75 lockdown, that's what it is, right?
Well, I hope that's what it is. I'm not looking at your paperwork.
Yes, that's what it is. It says 3.75.
That's for the interest rate. What about all the costs?
We would have to have come up with about maybe $3,000 closing costs.
Okay, that's pretty good. So, like I said, if you can get that deal, go get that deal. But if you can't get that deal, if suddenly that deal changes, I want you to make a spreadsheet. And that sounds like really fancy and complicated, but I want you to make a spreadsheet and I want you to list all of the different costs, because if you're looking at a HUD-1 form, you can actually see all the different costs.
Okay.
And I want you to go and compare those costs with different loans. And when you talk to the lender, say, well, what about this fee? What about this fee? What about this fee? Be really specific so that you understand exactly what you guys are getting into.
Okay.
All right?
All right. Thank you so much.
You let me know what happens, Sharon, and I'm pulling for you guys all the way. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I'm Elise Glink. We are rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB.
Expert money advice you can depend on anytime at ClarkHoward.com and midday every Sunday with Elise Glink on 95.5 FM and AM 750, News Talk WSB.
54 minutes past the hour, News Talk WSB. I'm Elise Glink, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Jennifer joins me on the line now from Atkinsville. Hey, Jennifer.
Hey there.
Welcome.
We're interested in buying a short sale home, and we've spoken to two different mortgage companies. The short sale means a lot of work to it, about $40,000 to $50,000.
Okay. And how much is the short sale going for?
I mean, it's listed at $240.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to put an offer in at $180 because of all the work that does need to be done to it.
Okay.
Like I said, we had spoke with two different mortgage companies, and one's telling me that I would need to do like a conventional loan and then do a construction loan and then refinance. So it would be almost three closings.
Yep.
Another one had told us that we could. They thought that they could do it all at one, a renovation loan.
Okay.
So I was wondering what's the best option, and our in-laws had just bought a house, and they only had to put 10% down and are not paying any PMIs as well. So would that be an option for us?
So I don't believe that your in-laws who only put 10% down are not paying PMI. I think what they've done is wrap the PMI into the interest rate.
Okay.
If you put down less than 20%, you are paying private mortgage insurance. I don't know how you're paying it. You're paying it in some way, shape, or form.
Okay.
So, and of course, the surest way to find out what they did is to call their mortgage broker or their lender who they used.
Uh-huh.
And to talk to them about what that loan actually looked like.
Okay.
But they may have not asked the right questions. But I will guarantee, I've got a 99% sure that if they put 10% down, they paid some form of private mortgage insurance, because that's just how the industry works.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about you and your loan. So you need 180, and you've got you want to buy it for, and then you need 40 or 50,000 in cash, and that takes you to about 230.
Mm-hmm.
So the first problem you're going to have with a short sale is that the bank is not going to probably take your offer at 180.
Okay.
Right? Because they're going to say to themselves, well, 240, do you know why it's listed at 240? Is 240 what the loan is?
I'm not sure. There are two, there's a first and a second on that. I do know that, but I don't know for how much.
Okay, so the first issue you're going to have is that you've got two loans on this property, and you've got a double negotiation you have to do, and the second lender is going to be really annoyed, and they're not going to want to give up the goat for anything.
Okay.
So I have to tell you, if you start down this path at the price point you're at, your biggest problem is going to be negotiating with the lenders, and you probably want to get a real estate attorney of your own to help you with that negotiation,
mm-hmm.
because I think it's going to be a tough negotiation, and it could take months and months and months for you to get there.
Okay.
So you have to decide if this is worth doing.
Okay.
And you have to have your lender, your agent, talk to the seller's agent about what the bank is actually looking for, what both lenders are looking for.
Well, and that's the problem. We did have our agent speak with them, and the bank hasn't done their appraisal yet, I guess is what it's called. And they said that they were not going to do one until somebody put an offer in.
Do you know what this property is actually worth?
Potentially it could be worth a good bit, but the siding's rotting off the house. I mean,
it's... No. Let's assume everything was fixed perfectly. What would the house be worth?
Probably about 260 to 280.
Okay, so if the house is really worth 260 to 280, and you know you have to put 50 into it, you then have to subtract down, and the lender's probably thinking to themselves they want 200 to 210 for the property. And you have to decide if you're willing to do that, and then you've got to go through the negotiation with it, and then you've got to figure out the financing. So I think if they don't want to do the work ahead of time, you're going to have your agent have to do a whole lot of work with pulling comps to prove what the property is worth in its current condition. And I would do a whole lot of work ahead of time, because that's really going to be the only way that this deal gets done. But I'm strongly encouraging you, Jennifer, to go hire a real estate attorney with a lot of experience negotiating with lenders. You've got double trouble with two lenders, and I want you to get this deal. 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Blink, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB.
When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner, and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours.
Good afternoon. afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Elise Blink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Our number, 404-872-0750. You can also call me at 1-800-WSB-TALK, or you can find me on Twitter, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K, and the website, thinkglink.com. So I wrote a story about a new report from WalletHub, which is a financial information and networking site that talks about Federal Housing Administration loans, FHA loans. In the last housing crisis, big Great Recession, FHA kind of came to the forefront. Normally, maybe 6 to 8% of homes that are bought will use an FHA loan. But FHA started doing, 23-30% of all the loans out there simply because many, many people had their credit destroyed. There was no way for them to qualify, and even if they could qualify, lenders weren't so interested in taking on their loans. And so we really saw FHA step up. However, FHA is now really gone back to being the place of last resort for people with bad credit. And the reason is it is so far underwater. And what by that I mean that the loans, many of the loans that they made have gone bad. They've had to pay out on the private insurance, the mortgage insurance, MI as it's called. And so they have jacked up the price of an FHA loan over at HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, in order to better cover the costs of the program. HUD has never had to take financing. It's always been kind of one of these government programs that pays for itself and then some. But its pot of cash has been severely diminished with this Great Recession. And so the price of a mortgage has gone up. And if you are looking for a mortgage and lack 20%, just as I told Sharon in the last hour, you know, you are paying for private mortgage insurance. And with FHA, those costs are really high. And so a new report has come out that you can save between $1,700 and over $12,000 just over 5 years by taking out a conventional loan with private mortgage insurance over an FHA loan. That is because the price has gone up. And so what the government is trying to do is make FHA the last resort again. The place to go where if you have bad credit and you can't get a loan in the conventional market, FHA is there to help you step into that world and to buy a house. As opposed to being the lender of first choice, it's the last place to go. So what we saw is FHA loan volume skyrocket 330% from 2007 to 2009, right? 330%. But 5 years ago, the cost of taking out a loan for a medium-priced home, around $212,000, you would have paid $9,200 in FHA premiums over the first 5 years of the loan. If you buy the house today, same house, same FHA mortgage insurance premium, $17,398, almost $17,400. That's the difference. There is a $8,000 increase for just a home price to $212,000. So this has created a real interesting swing for first-time home buyers with who are credit challenged, who really want to buy an FHA home, but it is less available, less affordable than it was. So I write this story, and it's gotten a fair amount of, you can see, I just tweeted out the link, and you can see it on CBS News. And I heard from Brian Sullivan, who's a Twitter follower of mine, and he's one of the top people in public affairs at HUD, Department of Housing and Urban Development, which oversees FHA. And he has said, you know, he confirms that FHA mortgage insurance premiums have gotten much more expensive. And it's important, he said, because FHA is trying to weather the storm of, you know, the fact that they're kind of broke, and they're trying to intentionally reduce the FHA footprint in the marketplace. But he just wanted everybody to know that when PMI is canceled after the borrower reaches 80% loan-to-value, that's what happens in the regular conventional market, right? You get to 20%, and you should be able to cancel your private mortgage insurance. And if it's within the first 5 years, sometimes it's 22%. But the private mortgage insurance company no longer assumes any risk in the loan, whereas FHA keeps the risk of the mortgage for the life of the loan, and the insurance coverage continues. And so he thought that was an important distinction. And I said, I don't think anybody buying a home even is aware of that, and nor do they care. And why should they? Right? Because it really isn't. If you get an FHA mortgage, or if you get a conventional mortgage, and you pay off PMI, or you get to the place in the loan where PMI gets canceled, you don't care that the lender doesn't have any coverage. It doesn't affect you. And with FHA, it doesn't affect you. It affects FHA. And so his distinction is that we should all care about that. And my distinction is, I don't know why we should all care about that. And FHA has played around with the ability of canceling the mortgage insurance. And now it's come back. It, really, during the recession, I was amazed. They actually, because you used to get PMI in FHA loans for the life of the loan. And then that went away for a few years. And now it's come right back again. So really interesting conversation that's going on right now about FHA loans. But they are far more expensive at the moment than getting a conventional mortgage. And if you can qualify for a conventional loan, you really are not going to want to opt for FHA or VA, for that matter. You're really going to want to go into the conventional market. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Janet joins me on the line. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I own a house that I would like to sell. And the gentleman across the street who rents has asked to buy it. But he has only been in the country just slightly less than 3 years, and a bank will not talk to him about a loan until he's filed 2 tax returns. So he asked me if I would consider financing it myself, and he would give me a pretty good size down payment. But I don't know. My neighbor seems to think this is a big mistake, because if I'd ever have to foreclose, it's really a mess trying to do it. And I don't know enough about this. And can you help me at all?
Sure. Let's walk through it. First of all, do you know the gentleman across the street?
Yes, I do.
And you've known him? He's lived there for the whole 3 years he's been in this country?
No, he hasn't lived there 3 years. Well, close to 3 years, I guess.
Okay. And is he a good neighbor?
Yes, he is.
Okay. And does he have a family?
Yes, he does. 2 children.
Okay. And what makes you think that he would not be a good buyer for your property?
The only thing that makes me wonder, and I know he is a tremendously hard worker because of the shape he's kept the rental house in, is the fact that he is involved in the construction industry.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's a very shaky industry to be in at this time.
Well, I would disagree with that and say that 5 years ago was a really shaky, really shaky for construction. But it depends what part of the construction industry he's in.
I know he lays tile.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he can do just about anything, but I believe his primary interest is tiling.
So here's what I like about the situation. I like that he has a big down payment for you. He's not going to walk away from that down payment. And even if he did, you would then have the down payment.
I would have to pay for all the foreclosure.
But you would have the down payment to help with that. And the foreclosure itself, if he's not contesting it, shouldn't be a big deal. And so you would be able to control the property and have a big chunk of cash to make you feel better. In addition, he probably will pay you above market interest rates. So you would go and put money in the bank at 1% or 2%, and he'll probably pay you 5%.
You think that's what personal financing gets?
Yeah. I think that when somebody is stuck and can't get a regular lender to do it, regular loans now for a 30-year fixed-rate loan are going in about 4 to 4.5%. He'll pay you a premium in order to get your property. If you're really worried about it, you could just have him do a lease with an option to buy in a year. So he'll move into the property. He'll pay you a non-refundable down payment fee. You take his rent for a year, which will more than cover your costs of the mortgage, if you have a mortgage left.
A small one left.
Fine. You pay the cost of the mortgage that way. And in a year, when he's able to qualify, he can then buy the house. There are lots of different ways to do this. But he sounds like, in the world of this kind of thing, where you can be very worried about it, that you know him, you know his family, you know he takes wonderful care of the property. If he moves into your house with a lease with an option to buy, you know what you're going to get, you know what the schedule is, and he's just waiting to be able to qualify for a loan. But I think you're taking a very small risk to actually be the lender here, and I like the idea of you doing it. So why don't you talk to a local real estate attorney, get that person involved, see what you can do in terms of, you know, making yourself feel comfortable with the documentation, which is what you're going to want to do, and then you've got your house sold, and you're not paying a commission to the agent, and you're not paying all kinds of fees. It's really a great deal for you, Janet. You just have to get yourself comfortable around it. 19 minutes past the hour. I'm Elise Glink, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinkglink.com and find Elise Glink live midday every Sunday on 95.5 FM and AM 750. News Talk WSB.
26 minutes past the hour on the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours. We have a prize pack to give away today. It includes a pair of tickets to see the Alliance Theater's presentation of A Christmas Carol, November 29th through December 29th on the Alliance stage, and a gift certificate for synthetic oil change, courtesy of Braxton Automotive. The prize pack value $289, and I think we're going to give it away to the fifth caller today. To our prize pack line, 404-741-0750. Good luck to you. 26 minutes past the hour, News Talk WSB. I'm Elise Glink. We are rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours here on News Talk WSB. You know, one of the things that I get asked most frequently when somebody's deciding what they're going to do with mortgages, what are my rules for a home run refinance? And as mortgage interest rates inch up again, back to towards maybe 4.5% for a 30-year fixed. I think it's instructive to understand what I mean about this home run refinance so that when you go out, you know it when you see it, right? So a home run refinance in my book is you definitely lower your interest rate, right? And number two, you're saving money every month. So the lower interest rate translates into saving money. The third thing is that you're shortening the loan term, and this may be the most important point of a home run refinance. You are shortening your loan term. So if you have 27 years on your loan, you get to go to a 20-year loan. If you have 20 years left, you go to a 15-year loan. If you have a 15-year loan, you go to a 10-year loan. Shortening the loan term will save you tens of thousands of dollars over the life of the loan. And the last piece of it, of this four-part home run refinance, is you watch your closing costs. Be very cautious about what costs you're getting folded into the interest rate and what you're paying out front, and make sure you compare that on an apples-to-apples basis. Four rules, home run refinance, only here on the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more on News Talk WSB. Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours here on News Talk WSB. Our number, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK, online all the time, thinkglink.com. Don't forget to check out my Twitter feed, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. There's all kinds of video up online now that we've been putting up at our YouTube channel, Expert Real Estate Tips, and you can find that out as well, Expert Real Estate Tips on YouTube, or just go to Twitter because we push it out there. It is 36 minutes past the hour. Let's go back to the phones. Ray joins me on the line from Johns Creek. Hi, Ray. Welcome to the program.
Yes, I've got a question. You talked about mortgages and to go with a conventional instead of a VA or an FHA. And I just did a streamlined refinance of my primary mortgage down to 3.75. But as a disabled vet, I don't have to pay the funding fee.
Mm-hmm.
I've also got a equity line, but I couldn't bundle those together because I was involved in a car wreck, and at the moment, until that gets settled, my credit's a little squirrely from some of the medical bills. So my question is, after I come out of that and I get the settlement from the lawsuit, would I still be better off looking at a conventional loan versus a VA or an FHA, or depending on how much is there, should I pay off my equity line and leave the 3.75 that I've got as an investment?
How long are you staying or owning this house?
I moved into the house in 2001. My wife and I right now are trying to decide, do we want to permanently stay in the house and do some other enhancements to it, or after we come out from under the lawsuit, possibly settle or sell the house and then buy another one.
So if it were me and I had 3.75% locked in, I would never get rid of it. As long as you could rent that house out and more than cover that cost, why would you get rid of that loan? That loan someday, you're going to see that as gold. You're going to say to yourself, that's gold. And so when you get the settlement, I would look to pay off the equity line and get rid of that, because it's going to be incredibly cheap for you to live in this property. Or if you then decide to rent it out, you should be able to, once the equity line is gone, more than cover your costs, right?
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, the equity line is like 55, and right now I had a lock on, I think, 25,000 of it, or 20,000 of it. It's 6.5%, and the other part's variable, which right now is like at 2%.
Right. Yeah, to me, you know, if you're going to have a chance at paying off this loan, do you think your settlement will more than cover the 55?
Yes.
So then I would just pay that off. Now you've got a loan at 3.75%. What does that cost you a month, including your taxes and insurance?
I think it's like $940.
And what do you think you could rent your property for?
Where we're at right now in Johns Creek, probably $15-$16 a month.
So if it's costing you $940 and you could rent it out for $1,600, that's what I mean when I say it's a pot of gold, because you're more than covering your costs, you're taking some cash out, and if you find good tenants, even if you find a good tenant and you give them a break at $1,400, provided they do the maintenance and upkeep on the property, you're still ahead of yourself.
So if we get the settlement on the lawsuit and we're thinking another house, go ahead and pay off the equity line, keep the primary mortgage and use it as a rental property, and use the rest of the money from the lawsuit for another house.
That's what I would do. And
okay.
If you feel as though you can't buy the new house and have enough money to pay off the 55, I would pay off the part at 20 that's locked in at 6.5%, and then just have the low interest rate on the variable, which will stay low for a while, and enjoy that as long as you can, and then pay it off when you're done with that. But I see this house for you as being an opportunity to leverage up and to make a smarter move. All right? Yeah, we've lost him. All right. 404-872-0750. Ray has definitely got an opportunity here to make some money. 404-872-0750. What about Art? Art, welcome to the program.
Hey, Elise. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We bought a house a couple of years ago, and I think that we're getting close equity-wise. We didn't have enough to put down to get rid of the PMI. But I think we're getting close. Do I need to pay for an appraisal, or can I find out if we're close enough to be able to kind of make a move on that to get rid of that PMI, getting close to that 20% some other way?
All right. So a couple of things. First of all, you will pay for an appraisal, but you don't want to pay for it until you're actually at the place where you really know you're going to be at the 20% rate.
Right.
And depending on when you bought this property, it might actually be 22%. So have you talked to your lender about this?
Have not yet.
Okay. So you need to talk to your lender and say, what are the steps I need to take for getting PMI canceled on my loan? And how do I go about doing it? And depending on when you bought your property, if it's within the first 5 years, they may say it's 22%.
Yeah, it's only been about 2.5 to 3.
So you have to ask them what the actual story is with that, because it would not surprise me if it was 22% within the first 5 years.
Gotcha.
So find out what steps you have to take, and then you usually have to make a formal application. And at that point in time, the lender hires the appraiser, and you pay for it. And if it does not appraise out, you've lost the money for the appraisal. I just want to be really clear.
Yeah. Is there any good way to how do I tell up how close I am? I mean, obviously Zillow and some things like that.
Zillow's a waste. I know the people behind it, but it's not, you know, same thing with Trulia. Those aren't real numbers. What you need to do is talk to your local real estate agent, maybe the person who sold you the house.
Okay.
And just say, if you were going to comp this house for an appraiser right now, what would it comp out at? So that you understand what other properties are selling for in the neighborhood, because that's what the appraiser's going to do. They're going to come in, they're going to look at all the houses that have sold in the last 6 months, and maybe even the last 3 months, and then they're going to try to establish a value for your property. So if your property, you think it needs to be at, say, $200,000 in order to get rid of your PMI, but everything else that's similar is selling for $180,000, guess what? You're not going to appraise out.
Nope.
So you have, unless you put a huge cash infusion into the house, and then maybe it will. But you have to understand kind of what's going on in the neighborhood in a very granular level.
Gotcha.
So I think your agent is probably the first place to go and have a conversation and say, you know, how would I comp this out? And she may say, or he may say, it's, you know, these six houses have sold. Or if you know what those houses have sold for, because you've been watching the neighborhood, you can go look those up online and find out what the actual sales prices are. It doesn't matter what the list price has been. What matters is what the sales price has been.
Right.
So that's what you should do. And you can even start that on your own if you know what houses have sold. There's actually a website called blockshopper.com.
Okay.
It's not everywhere in the country, but you could put in your own address, and then it pulls up what properties have sold for.
Cool.
So, like I said, it's not everywhere. I'm not sure it's in Atlanta. You can take a look online and see. But there are a bunch of other places like that, websites like that, that actually look at sales prices. Not list prices, sales prices.
All right, well, thank you.
You're very welcome. Good luck. I hope it works out. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK, The Elyse Glink Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time. Starting with yours, Carolyn, how can I help you today?
Well, I just wanted to make a comment. I noticed when you were talking to the guy in Johns Creek, I mean, telling him to rent is a no-brainer, but I have, and I'm a realtor, and I have so many people who go, oh, I don't want to be a landlord, and I'm like, why? I own 3 townhomes. I have very good luck. You just do the screening up front, and it's like having additional retirement. And what I do is, if I'm in a positive cash flow, which I am now after doing the HARP refinance, I just throw all the money toward my mortgage, and I'm hoping to have an income for retirement later. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Well, Carolyn, so that's really a good point. So let's talk about that for a minute, because my husband, Sam, who's a real estate attorney, really doesn't like being a landlord. He doesn't like having the response. He always says, I come up with the ideas and find the places to buy, and then he has to manage it day to day.
Yeah.
He says he doesn't like the division of labor. He would like a different division of labor. But the truth is that our properties are, to your point, pretty easy to manage, and it's very infrequent. But he feels sort of the weight of that on his plate when he has a lot of other things going on for the amount of the return. And so how do you counteract that feeling? Because a lot of people have it. It's not inside their bailiwick to manage the personality.
Well, I mean, I'm in real estate, so this is what I do, so I don't have any problem managing mine. And I've really got very little things that go wrong. I did buy them new, probably at the height of the market, so I have no intention of selling them, so it doesn't matter at this stage, but they're not at a maintenance, you know, high right now.
Mm-hmm.
But I would just go through a property management. They're going to take 10%, but they'll take care of all that kind of stuff.
All right. So, well, it's a good point, and I'm glad you called in to encourage people because, as you know, I'm a big believer in investing in real estate, and we've done pretty well for it for the different properties that we've had. The problem I have with some management companies is that while they do take money out and so it can really change the balance of whether something's affordable, you have to stay on top of the management company too. So it's all well and good to say, well, they'll take care of it. But my number one rule for managing money is this. Nobody cares about it as much as you do. They don't. And even if you hire somebody to manage it, they don't care about it as much as you do because you're the one who earns it, does without for it. You've put away, you've made choices that might have been very difficult in order to salt away that retirement. You probably had to make decisions that you wouldn't have wanted to make if you had had more cash resources. So nobody cares about your money as much as you do. And even if you hire a management company, it's not exactly the same. That said, if you've got an idea about buying real estate and you really can't manage it day-to-day because you live out of state or you get moved out of state, a management company is going to be the next best thing. But evaluate them carefully and find out what people think about that company and the treatment that they have been given. And I guarantee you'll find it online. Google and Bing are going to be your best friends in that endeavor. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I'm Elise Glink, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. It's 55 minutes past the hour on the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Monica joins me on the line. Hey, Monica, how can I help you?
Hi, Alicia. So I was actually calling in regards to your recent comment on the conventional versus FHA, given that the PMI is now a requirement for the life of the loan.
Yep.
I'm actually shopping loans now as a new home buyer, and FHA appealed to me, obviously, because of a lower credit score and ability to get the loan without such a high interest rate with conventional. So I guess for me personally, maybe 7 to 10 years or 5 to 7 years was my initial time period I was looking at staying at the house. So would I break even on both loans pretty much if it gave me a higher interest rate with conventional?
Well, let me be really clear that if you get a lower interest rate with FHA and you're able to get the house, you should go with that, right? Because over a long period of time, and you don't know, you think it's going to be 5 to 7 years, but for a lot of people, FHA is going to be the only option for them. If you have both, and you can understand where it's going to be, but you're going to have PMI for both of it and a higher interest rate, over the 5 to 7 years, the FHA is going to be a cheaper deal for you. If it's going to be longer than that, you're going to get beyond the 20% and be able to drop PMI, then it's not going to be a better deal to go with FHA. So what you really need to do is calculate how much you're paying on each loan over the next 5 to 7 years. That's the way you make a smart move. So do that, and you'll figure it out. Thanks for calling, Monica. It is 57 minutes past the hour. The music's playing, and that means our time is up. So join me again next week for another Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time. And in the meantime, find me on Twitter, @Glink, @GLINK. I'm on Google+, and, of course, at my website, thinkglink.com. I hope you have a great and productive week, and I'll meet you back here next week for another edition of our show. Take care, everybody. Have a good one.